Hey, what's up, everybody? Our guest today is Howie Cohen. Throughout his 52-year career in advertising, he went from just being another aspiring writer from the Bronx to being known for some of the most iconic advertisements of all time, like the Alka-Seltzer ad, "I can't believe I ate the whole thing," or like when they blew up Jack in the Box because they reformulated their food. So he had an amazing career, and it was honestly an honor and a privilege.
Hello.
Hi, Howie.
Nice to see you again.
Good to see you too, man. It's been a minute.
It's been an important minute. A few things have happened in your life.
Yeah, and yours.
Well, congratulations on your baby and about to be baby.
Thank you. Thank you. It's an exciting time.
And the book is going to be my baby.
Yeah, so yeah. You're about to have your own.
I'm excited.
You've been working on this, your baby, for quite some time now, right?
Well, you know, I started blogging about 10 years ago under the moniker Mad Mensch. Mm-hmm. And it was just trying to get a feel for storytelling beyond what I was familiar with in advertising. I'd probably written 1,000 TV commercials, but they were all in 30-second bursts. Can I think beyond that? Can I think a page, two pages, tell a whole story? And so I started to get my a feel for it on my blog, and I really enjoyed the writing. And a lot of the disciplines I learned in advertising really applied, like coming up with a snappy opening, having a fertile middle, and always ending with a little punchline, mm-hmm. is very much evident in my book, in the chapters of my book, which is, and I've gotten comments on that. But just being able to tell interesting stories with humor and heart, mm-hmm. it's what I was always good with in advertising, and it really helped me with the book. So over the course of about 4 years, I wrote lots of blog posts, and I got tremendous responses, you know, particularly from people in advertising, about the humor and how much they loved the stories, the history of advertising, but also the laughs they got. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And what a shot in the arm that was for me. You know, I really felt much more confident about it.
Yeah.
So I did it for about 4 years, and then I left it. And when I retired about 2 years ago, I thought, you know, I really have wanted to write this book, and people have asked me to write this book, and I'll give it a shot. And actually, I had probably half the book from my blog posts, so it was a great start. But then, of course, you got to figure out what's the shape of your whole story,
yeah.
and how do these anecdotes fit. So that was my challenge for the last couple of years or more. I've been putting it together. And now it's about to be birthed.
Yeah. a week away.
I'm really excited. I sent advanced copies out for reviews, and I got tremendous reviews. A few people have read advanced copies, and they've given me reviews on Amazon. So I think it's, I'm very confident it's a good book,
yeah.
an enjoyable book, and that people can learn a lot from the book because, hey, I was in the business for 52 years.
Yeah.
I must know something.
There's a lot there. There's a lot of experiences, a lot of successes, failures, just overall learnings, so much that everybody can absorb, even if they're not working in advertising, you know?
Yep. I'm glad you brought up the failures because I actually decided to start. I think the first, it's called the prologue, is a failure. I'm starting right in with a failure.
I love that.
This is not a book about look at me, and then I wrote. This is the real stuff. And thrilling and exciting victories, rewarding stuff, and a lot of pain that you learn from. Mm-hmm. But that's life. That's
it
anybody's
is.
Life.
Right? It is.
So that's why I named the book after my famous commercial, which was "I can't believe I ate the whole thing." The book is "I can't believe I lived the whole thing."
Yeah. Yeah. And failures are something you shouldn't run away from. You know,
no.
Unfortunately, that's something that it invokes a lot of fear in people. You know, the grading system in school, the F is like the worst thing that can happen. But as I've grown and learned, that the failures are the things that have changed me towards going in the right direction.
Yeah.
Because the pain is something you want to avoid. And that's what forces you, puts a fire under your butt to like really look at yourself and look at what you're doing and how you can actually improve.
Absolutely. And I really think you learn a lot more from your mistakes and your failures than you do from your successes. A lot of successes are based on hard work and luck.
Mm-hmm.
But when you fail, you got to really do a little self-examination, take it apart, think, what did I do wrong? What did they do wrong? What can I do better next time? And and that's how you grow.
Yeah, because if you succeed, you just have a drink and enjoy the, you know, enjoy the party.
And, you know, it's not real life to just succeed and succeed and succeed.
Yeah.
But I think that's also what makes life interesting.
Mm-hmm. Definitely. As the industry's evolved since you began in 65, you said?
65 was my first job in advertising.
And did you start out as an intern? Refresh my memory.
No, I decided to try and be a copywriter when I graduated from college in 64.
That's right.
Took me 6 months to get my first job. As I say in my book, I struggled to break in, you know. Mm-hmm. I stumbled, I slid, I sucked wind, and then I got lucky. I got an interview at Doyle Day & Birnbeck, the most creative agency on the planet, where everything was happening. That was where the Volkswagen Bug campaign was happening, Think Small. Avis, We Try Harder was happening. You Don't Have to Be Jewish to Love Levy's Rye Bread. And all the sharp, smart, human creatives who understood a different kind of advertising were being gobbled up by Doyle Day & Birnbeck. And they were looking for a copy trainee. So I was lucky enough to have a cousin who was in advertising. He started a couple of years before me, and he was doing pretty good. Mm-hmm. And he advised me to put together my own book of samples. And I said, what is that? He said, well, you know, just go through magazines, find ads you think really suck, and then do your own. And it doesn't have to be fancy. You don't have to have pretty pictures. Stick figures will do. What they're really interested in is the idea. Mm-hmm. Do you get it? Are you creative? And so that's what I did. You know, I sat at my mother's kitchen table. I have to go back to set up this story because I thought I was going to be an iron worker. My grandfather was an iron worker, and he had his own little company in the Bronx. My father worked for him and helped build up the company.
Wow.
And yeah, I was going to be an iron worker. So, you know, during the summers, that's where you'd find me welding, torching, painting steel.
Getting ready to take over the family business someday.
Getting ready to take over, but also getting ready to just jump into a job,
yeah.
You know, and not have to fight for finding a job and
exactly.
Getting a decent salary, I guess.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, it was not glamorous. It was in the Bronx, the dirty Bronx, a bad section of the Bronx. And not that I was above that, but I wasn't really that kind of handy person. I always like to dream and write poetry and use my creativity to create things that never were.
Was it the movies, the music, the creative, the stuff that was out there at the time that really probably filled you with that, right?
Yeah, and also advertising. I, when I was 13, I was bar mitzvahed. The best present I ever got, my three aunts, my Jewish aunts, chipped in. Aunt Minnie, Aunt Ruth, and Aunt Esther chipped in and got me a Wallensack reel-to-reel tape recorder. And I used to sit for hours in my room making up skits and characters and accents, and I just loved it.
Yeah.
And I loved the funny radio ads I heard on the radio. And so there was something about advertising that always appealed to me. But, you know, I was going to take the natural path of being an iron worker. So here's what happened. I come to work one day, 8 o'clock in the morning. I pull on my coveralls, put on my steel-toed boots. I start getting to work, and I'm painting, and I'm doing this, and I'm doing that. And hours, I'm in my mind, hours and hours, half the day. And I look up at the clock. It's 10:30 in the morning. I said, how am I going to do this the rest of my life? I hate it.
Yeah.
But when I sat at my mother's kitchen table, it was exactly the opposite. You know, I got lost in my musings and thinking of ads. And when I thought it was like 11 in the morning, it was time for dinner.
Yeah.
And that tells you something. When you're doing something you love, and I loved it. So I put together a book of spec ads, and finally I got the interview, because I was rejected by lots of agencies. I got the interview with Doyle Day & Birnbeck, and he saw something in me. He wasn't sure. He liked some of my ads, didn't like others. His name is Leon Meadow, an elderly, kindly elderly gent. And he said, Howard, you know, we've been looking at hundreds of applicants for this job. Mm-hmm. And I don't know if you got it. There's something about you I like, but you know what? I'm going to give you the agency test, copy test. I said, oh, great, copy test. What's that? <It's> like, and the copy test was to do a campaign for Webster's New World Dictionary of the American Language. And the difference about this dictionary was that it included the slang and colloquialisms you wouldn't find in a proper English dictionary. And so I excitedly took this assignment home, and I naturally went to a place that has sort of been typical of my whole career, mm-hmm. to a people place. You know, a dictionary can be a very dry thing.
Yeah.
And my campaign was the people and how they use these slang and unusual expressions. So one ad was a Jewish grandma standing in the kitchen. She's got a hand to her cheek. And she's saying, that's the picture. And the headline says, Fanny Bernstein says things like, oy vey, we put them in our dictionary. And it was just a simple little human thing, you know, kind of like a clue to what. Well, I brought that to Leon Meadow. He looked at it. He looked at other things. I'm sitting there like, did I pass the copy test? Does he like it? Is he smart? He was smiling. And then he looks up and he says, Howard, this is a very challenging business and you're a very young man. Are you sure you're up to it? And I started talking fast and furious. I said, Leon, I love advertising. I could have a job as an iron worker tomorrow. I could make more money. They really want me. But I love, this would be my path. And he stops me and he says, Howard, you can stop talking. You got the job.
So like, I get it. You're good.
Yeah. But my passion, and, you know, I just,
it came out. Yeah.
It came out. So I started my career in March of 65 at Doyle Dane Burnback for $6,200 a year, which was not horrible. It was decent. You know, I could buy lunch.
Yeah.
but the business was changing so fast. Young, creative people, ethnic people, was suddenly in high demand. Jewish copywriters and Italian art directors, a lot of because of the work that Doyle Dane Burnback was doing. And because they were in short supply, it was all new, they were all coming into the business, the salaries started to go up, competing to hire these people. And so little guys like us were starting to make some good money. You know, I took a jump, and I took another jump, and then I took another job, and I took another jump, and pretty soon I was making a lot of money after only 3 years in the business.
Amazing. So, and how old were you at this point?
Well, I started as a 22-year-old copy trainee, and at 25, I was at Wells Rich and Green, poised to work on some big TV campaigns. And the Wall Street Journal got wind of these young kids making big money, and they did an article titled The Rich Kids. I don't know how, but they somehow got my name. I'd only been in the business 3 years, and they did an interview over the phone, and it inadvertently resulted in a cute quote. But the Wall Street Journal said, Howard Cohen is reported to be 23 years old and making $25,000 a year. Not so, says Mr. Cohen. I'm 25.
You got my age wrong.
So, yeah, it was a very, very exciting time, an explosion of creativity. New things were being tried. New things were being done that really changed the pop culture. And it just kept growing and growing. And the business, the Mad Men era was basically dying. The creative revolution was starting. And the world was wide open to all of us.
Dig into the creative revolution a little bit. I want to really understand what you mean by that.
Well, you know, prior to, say, Doyle Dane Burnback and the work they were doing, it was, I call, a very waspy business, a very stiff business, a business of selling, mm-hmm. of manipulation, of convincing you of facts and rational and, you know, I mean, for example, they had a campaign, I think it was for Anison, aspirin product called Anacin, mm-hmm. and the obnoxious campaign was hammers banging on heads.
Like a headache, yeah.
Yeah, and it was a headache. they were trying to push very hard to sell. Some called it yell and sell. It was only when Doraldane Birnbach started to introduce humanity, emotion, humor, self-deprecation, that the whole language started to change and the whole feel of advertising started to change.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And it was perfect for these young ethnic kids, you know, Jewish copywriters and Italian art directors off the streets of Brooklyn and the Bronx. This is how they grew up, you know. There were jokes at the kitchen tables.
Yeah.
And it was fun. So this is what I call the creative revolution.
Yeah.
It was
everything was changing.
Is that me?
I think so. But you can get it. I'll clip this out.
Okay. Let me shut this off. We good?
Yeah, yeah.
So it was a revolution in the way we approached the language of advertising. And it aimed at the heart as opposed to beating you over the head.
Right.
And it relied on your intelligence to understand something and feel something. And so it led to a greater sense of being attached to a brand as opposed to being told to buy a product.
For this and this reason.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, reasons are good. Reasons are good support for something that you connect with emotionally. You know, we all have affinities for certain kinds of products, certain brands that speak to our sensibility, our values,
mm-hmm.
Our heart. I keep going back to the heart. You know?
Yeah.
And so that was the revolution. It was a total change in the language of advertising, in the look of advertising. It was a change in the pop culture. And it started right about the mid-60s, heading into the late 60s, right through the 70s. Everything was different, and all of a sudden, agencies were popping up with ethnic names. Jews were taking over, and on the creative side,
yeah, the writing
and art direction.
Mm-hmm.
I say Italian. I mean, these are cliches. Obviously, there were a lot of really good Jewish art directors and a lot of really good Italian writers,
mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
But it was sort of a cliche that worked. You know?
Yeah, I keep thinking of Saul from Mad Men. I actually have a few questions that I wrote down that I really wanted to ask, unless you wanted to keep going with that. But
well, I'm like Trump. I want my questions in advance. No, yeah. Just kidding.
Well, I'm going to put you on the spot then.
Don't say I'm like Trump, please.
No. Don't you worry. How did your learnings about the human condition through working in advertising affect your perspective on life or your relationships in your life?
I learned a lot through advertising, you know, going to, I would say until I got into advertising, I was fairly clueless. I was a kid from the Bronx. I grew up in a one-bedroom apartment. My parents slept on a Castro convertible sofa in the living room. My brother and I shared the bedroom. We all shared one bathroom, and the train went by the window.
Oh, my.
So, it sounds a little like a Woody Allen movie, but I have to tell you, it was a neighborhood. You know, we all grew up that way.
Yeah.
There were some wonderful things about it. You can just go down. You knew everybody, all the kids in the neighborhood. You play stickball in the street.
Yeah.
We had all these kid games. So, but, you know, I can't say that I learned a lot of the important things of culture, painting, design, architecture. Those all started to come to me when I got into the advertising business and met really talented, artistic people. All of a sudden, and I was starting to make money, I had to figure out, what does a good chair look like? What's a couch? What goes on the window? I didn't know any of this stuff.
Yeah.
And I had art directors come over and say, you know, try this. And did you ever hear of like the Bauhaus? And,
yeah.
You know, I was being educated and I was growing from the business that I was instructed to bring something too. So it was kind of a symbiotic relationship.
What you learned from your upbringing taught you something that the business could never teach you. It was that human connection.
Yeah. Yeah, I was blessed to have a really good family. My mother worshipped and adored me. That led to a kind of Pollyanna approach I've always had to life, where I just believe everything's going to be fine. I'm the golden child. My mother told me this, and I believed her. It's in the book. And all the neighbors just thought I was the cutest, most adorable little boy in the world. But Howie, she said, you know, they're going to have to get their own little adorable boy because you're all mine. And this is interesting, too, because my wife grew up very differently. You know, she learned to be cautious. Mm-hmm. She learned to look at life through a very different lens, being careful and not trusting everybody and everything. And it took me a long time to get a little bit of healthy side of a worldview from her.
Which balance is critical, I feel like.
Yeah, and I think I've given her a little bit of optimism.
Of course. It works both ways. My wife and I are very similar in that sense. Our personalities are different in a similar way. And I've noticed over the years that we're on two extremes and we help each other lean towards the middle.
Yeah.
I mean, that's exactly, really nice.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And there's a lot of funny stuff in the book, too, about that. At one point, I had cancer. And my doctor thought I might have cancer. He sent me to the oncologist, and Carol and I went over to Cedars. And he looked at my charts, and he did some tests, and finally came to the conclusion. And he said, how are you? You have stage 4 non-Hodgkin's lymphoma. But it's the good kind, if there is a good kind.
Yeah.
It's the B cell, slow moving, blah, 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 blah. So I seized on that. Mm-hmm. We left that meeting and we're standing at the elevator and I said, that went well. Carol said, went well, Howie. He just told you you have cancer. I said, yeah, but he said I'm going to make it.
He said it's the good kind.
Right. So that is the perfect expression of the difference between me and my wife.
Yeah. And it's interesting that, because an upbringing where you're told that, like, you're awesome and you're the best might cause some people to become arrogant and conceited. But I've never got that vibe from you.
No.
Where'd the humility come from, do you think?
I think another thing my parents taught me was respect for other people, liking people, loving certain people.
Yeah.
And I guess an appreciation for what we had. I can't say I haven't been arrogant at times. I guess we all have. But as a person, I love people. And I treat people the same no matter what station they come from.
Yeah.
And I think what I get back from that is as much as I give. I feel good when people feel comfortable around me.
Mm-hmm.
So I always try to create a comfortable environment, whether it's in a business thing or a family thing or a friend thing. I want you to know I care about you and I appreciate you.
There is joy contained in the human spirit. And if you can facilitate an environment where everyone can release that, if you feel good.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. And getting back to the Pollyanna thing, that also opens me up to some disappointments because there have been friends who've really, not too many, but I've been screwed over.
We all have. Yeah.
And probably ones that my wife warned me about, since I was a Pollyanna, I didn't hear it.
So. Yeah, yeah. It's okay. That it's a lesson to learn. That's a different kind of life lesson, failure in a way.
Yeah, and I think what I have to give in this book, too, is a lot of not just advertising lessons, but life lessons, because it's so much about life, about friendships, humor, marriage. I mean, we're about to celebrate our 46th wedding anniversary.
Congratulations.
I got lucky. I got a great woman.
Mm-hmm.
You know, without being a preachy book, I share my experiences and tell my stories and put you in those rooms and you hear the dialogue. And I think people feel comfortable just absorbing it, and that's how you learn.
Yeah.
That's the best way to learn.
Exactly. Through someone else's life experience, because you can't fake that.
Exactly.
You have to go through it.
Exactly.
Yeah, it's not a story that you can just make up. Do you recall any times where you experienced a moral dilemma on the job where you worried that either the marketing or the product you were marketing could cause some sort of unwanted side effect or harm potentially?
Yes. Yes, back in the early 70s, Wells Rich and Green had the Benson and Hedges account,
mm-hmm.
and was doing very funny, fresh, original advertising that sold a lot of cigarettes. I wasn't working on the account, but at one point they needed a new campaign, and they asked me and my partner to work on it. I wrestled with it because it wasn't quite as crazy as it, you know, as it got, as people understood.
Yeah. How much did they know at the time?
They still knew a lot. I mean, they talked about this stuff back in the 50s,
mm-hmm.
maybe even the 40s.
Wow.
But the research started to come out much more.
Before then, it was anecdotal. It was like, this happened to this person who smoked a lot. This happened to this person who smoked a lot. Was it kind of like that? Or was it in the media? How did you just heard about it, I guess?
We knew smoking was bad for you going back to probably the 40s and 50s.
Okay.
And in those days, they were shameless. I mean, they did campaigns about more doctors recommend Camels.
Yeah, yeah. I've seen some of those.
Unbelievable. Anyway, I was asked to work on it with my partner, and we wrestled with it. We decided we weren't going to take a big moral stand on it. We actually wanted to see if we could come up with something that was interesting.
Mm-hmm.
We worked on it and did come up with a couple of campaign ideas. And I guess my moral compass wasn't as strong as it is now. But fortunately, we did campaigns that didn't get bought. So I don't have it on my conscience.
Yeah, that's good. That's good. But you wrestled with it, you know, it was there because you knew.
Yeah, I would never want to use my talents to hurt people. Oh, my God.
Yeah, exactly. That's the worst feeling. When you see today's advertising and how it's evolved and is evolving, do you ever have moments where you smile and say, wow, like something's never changed? A thread that sort of ties it back to when you were working on it, or something about humans that just stayed consistent?
Well, I wish there was more good advertising. But I have to say, even then, there wasn't a lot of good advertising. There was always more, you know, 80-90% of advertising was garbage.
Yeah.
And then every once in a while, you'd see something that would inspire you, that was clever and didn't talk down to you,
mm-hmm.
and wasn't condescending, and actually lifted you and inspired you, you know. And
yeah.
And also then there were great campaigns that did a lot of good, you know, like the Peace Corps campaign. I remember one line that early in my career that I saw for the Peace Corps. I think it was, it's the toughest job you'll ever love.
Wow. Yeah.
Simple, you know.
Yeah.
Simple.
Straight to the
and
heart.
True. And so I think advertising can do a lot of good for humanity. I worked when I had my own agency in New York. This was after Wells Rich and Green. We took on as a pro bono account the Soviet Jewry account. And their job, their goal was to help free Jews who weren't allowed to leave Russia. They were being persecuted. They were being put in jail. Some mm-hmm. of them were being executed.
Wow.
And so the head of this was Elie Wiesel, the great humanitarian who was a survivor of concentration camps. And we met him. It was an honor to meet him. And but by the way, just a little side story. Do you remember on Saturday Night Live the Emily Latella character?
Yeah.
She did a bit on Soviet Jewry. What is this all talk about Soviet jewelry? If I want jewelry, why would I go all the way to Russia to get? No, it's Jewry, Soviet Jewry. Oh, never mind. So that was going on.
Yeah.
And one day tragedy struck. Some terrorists broke into a school in Israel and killed 23 children.
Oh, my God.
What a horror. And we got a call from Elie Wiesel, and he said, we have to do something. It was already in the newspapers, but he said, they have to hear from us, from our perspective. He wanted to be in the New York Times the next day with a full-page ad. So this was like, in a way, the biggest ad we were ever going to do, and it had to be done in one day.
Yeah, talk about a late night. Yeah.
It turned out to be a huge headline filling up the page. And it was written out by my partner, Bob Pasqualina, in his chicken scrawls. And the headline was, see if I can remember, while you were sleeping, 23 Israeli children were slaughtered in their classrooms. Wake up. And then it was copy about what's going on.
Whoa.
So we took this headline over to Ellie's apartment. He lived on the west side, and he immediately loved it. He only had one question. He said, why are you calling them Israeli children? These are Jewish children. I said, well, I thought it was just more relevant because it happened in Israel.
Right.
He said, Howard, what is more relevant than being a Jew? Changed it right there.
Yeah.
So he said, yes, let's do it. So we ran back to the agency, and we were on the east side, and Bob found a really bold typeface, and he set this thing and that strong headline. I wrote two short lines of copy about what people can do, and we ran back to the west side, took the ad out, showed it to Elie, and so he said, what is this? This is not what we agreed on. I said, what? It's exactly what we talked about. He said, no, your chicken scrawls, what you did with your hand was perfect. These are children. And it was perfect. It stood out. And oh my God, he was right. You know, we had out-slicked ourselves.
Yeah, you overthought it.
Yeah. Bob went back and did the whole thing in chicken scrolls, and boy, did that ad stand out in the New York Times.
Yeah.
It was a great moment, but also, you know, to my point of being able to do something good through advertising.
Yeah, that's huge.
Yeah.
And it's funny because that happens all the time. Overthinking. Something works. It's good. It's fine. And then you try and make it better.
Well, let's make it professional.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. There's so many different ways to just overcook the ad.
Outsmart yourself.
Right? Yeah. I do it all the time. Something that I have to consciously try and avoid sometimes.
Right.
Yeah. Is there anything about the era that you miss, that creative revolution that was going on, or the late 60s while you were working there? You mentioned earlier that there was something sexy about advertising at that time.
Well, it was, of course, you know, I'm looking at this through the lens of being a very young man in a very exciting and glamorous business.
True.
In New York, at the most creative agencies on the planet, where everything was happening.
And
we moved at Welsridge Green. We moved to the General Motors building. It was brand new. Overlooking Central Park, we're on the 24th floor, and there's beautiful people everywhere.
Yeah.
I mean, the guys were beautiful. The girls were beautiful. And we all loved each other. I mean, we loved each other. Copywriters are dating secretaries. You know, media people are dating production people. And then it's change partners and start all over again.
Yeah, yeah. It adds an electricity to things.
Oh, yeah. So, you know, it's the age of miniskirts, and if a pretty girl bent down, you could see all the way to Cleveland, right? And it was just thrilling. So this was going on. There was a lot of, we were young. We were saying, actually, some of the married guys were letting their hair and their wives down, too, which was not so nice. But at some point, Mary Wells Lawrence got wind of what was happening. So one day I'm sitting in my office with my art director, and a guy knocks on the door. His name was Hank. We called him Hank the Snitch because he was anything that was going on, he would report back to Mary.
Ah.
And he comes in the office and he says, gentlemen, I knew we were in trouble then. Gentlemen, he says, I'm going from office to office. It's going to take me all day and maybe into tomorrow. But I'm delivering a very important message, and it's from Mary Wells Lawrence herself. And I quote, do not dip your quill in the company ink.
What a way to put it, huh?
So everything kind of went underground. I know it didn't stop, yeah, but things went underground. It wasn't quite as blatant. But, you know, in terms of, like, was it an exciting time? Yes, it was. You know, we were only about 6 years away from the invention of the pill. So now women, you know, were kind of in control, preventing birth.
Right.
It wasn't just the rhythm method or condoms.
You know? Yeah.
And so that opened the doors and everything else, mm-hmm, to wild sexual and creative freedom. And, you know, that made it very exciting. And then a few short years later, 69, Woodstock happened. So I went to Woodstock.
There it is.
I was at Woodstock, and it was an amazing experience. All the incredible legends of music were there, and on the second day, it was also uncomfortable. It was rainy, it was muddy, we were under tarps, but it was a spirit that, you know, 400,000 people showed up, and it changed society in a way.
Yeah,
everybody heard about it. And we're walking up to the grounds where the concert was, and there's a little lake, a large pond, little lake. And my friend Gary and I were there. He was an art director. He was taking pictures of everything. Mm-hmm. So out of the corner of our eye, we see people are starting to strip down, take their clothes off, jump in the lake. So Gary and I look at each other. You want to go down there? And, yeah, let's go down there. So we go down there, and we get up the nerve to get down to our skivvies. And now there's maybe a couple of hundred of young people throwing up their clothes, splashing, laughing. And we decided we're going to do it. So we get naked. Well, 20 years later, 1989, Life magazine decided to devote an entire issue to Woodstock. And they put an ad in the papers in New York. If you were there, send us a story in 25 words and a picture. So Gary sent a picture of me in my underwear. And they loved it.
That's awesome.
So,
can I use that as the cover for this podcast episode?
Absolutely. I'll show you the picture.
All right, I'll take a picture of the picture.
So the picture is in Life magazine, and they want to promote the issue. So they somehow got my, everybody gets my name somehow. I don't know how. And they fly me to New York to be on Good Morning America with two other people. And while I'm waiting to go on, we're in the green room, and there's a promo for our segment. And what's on the promo? The picture of me in my underwear.
That's amazing.
But since it's network TV, they use one of those blurry circles around my private area. And to be really careful, they used a very large blurry circle. So I never felt like such a manly man in my life.
Wait, I thought you had your underwear on. You were.
It was my underwear, but you know.
But yeah, especially at that
and
time.
And it was wet.
Yeah, there you go. They boosted your ego a little bit with the big circle.
Exactly.
Oh, man, that's funny.
So this, you know, when I talk about advertising was changing the pop culture, all these things were changing the pop culture. I don't talk about Vietnam. I think it's, you know, it was a horrible time. But in advertising, it was a very exciting time.
How so? What made it advertising exciting?
Well, everything I'm talking about the doors opening up to new expressions,
right,
and
that's right,
sexiness. And, you know, Wells Rich Green, Mary had not just the ability to inspire great advertising campaigns, she had business ideas. So, you know, Mary was responsible for the idea to paint Braniff planes in different colors. And to adorn their stewardesses in sexy poochie outfits. All of a sudden, she brought glam to the airline business, which was, you know, a totally gray steel business up to then.
Yeah.
And put Braniff on the map. That was a Mary idea. That was a business idea. Mm-hmm. Likewise, she had an idea for, we had a client called Menley and James. Mary came up with the idea for a product line called Love Cosmetics. I don't know if you remember that.
Mm-mm.
But it was a line of lipsticks and other things, but the lipsticks were in cylindrical package that looked extremely phallic. And they introduced Love, and she had the idea to hire a young very pretty photographer's assistant by the name of Allie McGraw. This was before Goodbye Columbus and Love Story, and they paid her $100,000 to do this campaign. And everybody's like, what are you, crazy? That's a fortune. But Mary knew. She just instinctively knew. And they launched a whole line of products. And then by 1969, they were pretty racy ads. By 1969, the headline of one of the love ads was, "This is love in 69." A little bit on the edge.
Yeah.
But, in the right context, I guess sex works.
Yeah. Nowadays, context doesn't even matter. Everyone just uses it everywhere, you know?
Yeah, but that's what's wrong with it because...
Yeah, I agree.
One of the first things I learned at Doralene Bernbeck was humor has to grow out of the product. It's not a joke for a joke's sake.
Yeah.
The funny print ads for Volkswagen, funny or ironic, Lemon, Think Small... Will we ever kill the bug? They were just really clever things that put a smile on your face, but they all grew out of a product feature that helped sell the product.
A truth.
Yeah. Now you just hear unrelated jokes, and that's why it's so hard to remember. Even if you remember the commercial, you don't remember what it was for.
Yeah, completely. And I think that's part of the reason why the best comedy, stand-ups, jokes or whatever, come from a trueness, a truth in the person's life that they experienced, that they felt, that they saw.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly.
The one that comes to the ad that I always remember is the second place has to work harder. Is that how it went? I can't remember exactly how that ad went.
Oh, the Avis campaign was, we're number two, try harder.
That's right. Yeah.
And there's a logic to that. It was unheard of to do advertising like that.
Exactly.
You can admit you're number two. And
that's why it makes you genius.
Yeah. And you don't have to be Jewish to love Levi's. They had big posters in the subway. An American Indian, you don't have to be Jewish to love Levi's. A wide-eyed Asian, you don't have to be Jewish to love Levi's. So this was breaking new ground, and it was from people who, they didn't have a roadmap,
Mm-hmm.
Now when people do advertising, they can Google something, they can go on Getty, they can find an image and put something to that. We didn't have that. You had to draw what was in your head.
Yeah.
So these were the geniuses who really pioneered very fresh, new kinds of thinking that, I say, changed the pop culture. All of a sudden these ads catapulted out of advertising and became part of the language. I can't believe I ate the whole thing.
Yeah.
The first one was, try it, you'll like it. Everybody's saying, try it, you'll like it.
Yeah.
Because it struck a nerve and it was so usable.
Mm-hmm. Awesome. I got a few more, and then we'll close on the Mad Men.
I could do a couple hours.
All right, let's go. Let's go as long as it goes. You already answered that. How do you exercise creativity these days? You're a creative guy. As long as I've known you, I remember one time you said you feel the most alive when you're creating.
I do.
So what do you do nowadays? Now that you're retired?
Well, my attention has been toward the book.
That's right.
The last couple of years, and that's taken a lot of time and given me a lot of pleasure.
Mm-hmm.
But more basically, I'd say my mind is always thinking creative stuff, whether it's meaningful or not. Mostly not meaningful. I mean, I'm coming up with ideas for products and businesses and that will never go anywhere, but they give me a smile.
Yeah, yeah.
And that some of them are off color, and some of their jokes I'll just tell to my friends.
Yeah.
But in my book, I talk about a product I invented. This was going to be my plan B. In our business, from the time you get into the business, there's a cliche going around like there are no 50-year-old copywriters or art directors. You're past your prime. Young people are taking over.
You're out of touch. Yeah, whatever they say.
So a lot of people started thinking about what would be their plan B. What would they do? And I don't think I really ever worried about that, but I still wanted a plan B. So my plan B was a product, a fabulous product called Cohen's Famous Chopped Liver. And it was based on a recipe handed down from my Jewish grandparents from Poland. And I was serious about this because I had a great campaign line that I thought would be bigger than I can't believe I ate the whole thing and try it, you like it. So I actually did a test spot for this. I'm wearing an apron. I got a meat cleaver in my hand. And the copy went, when I was a kid, my father would come home and he'd say, "Where's Howie?" And my mother would say, "In the kitchen making chopped liver." And he'd say, "Making chopped liver? That kid's not normal. He should be out playing stickball like his brother Jerry." And my mother would say, "Sam, chopped liver is his life." And so, and you know what? It still is my life. I make Cohen's famous chopped liver, and I make it with fresh chicken livers and hard-boiled eggs and fried onions. And then the camera moves into my face, and I say, "And you know what? I never skimp on the schmaltz." So when people tell me about famous people like Muhammad Ali and Robert Redford, I say, "What am I, chopped liver?" And that was the campaign. I was going to do it. And the only thing that stopped me is knowing how bad this food is for you. You know, I mean, it'll clog up your organs before it hits your... As a friend said to me at the time, "Howie, your chopped liver will kill more Jews than Hitler." So, to save humanity, I killed the chopped liver.
Hey, I guess you had to, man. It's really rich liver. You can't have too much of it. You gotta just have a little.
And the schmaltz is rendered chicken fat. I mean, that stuff just go right to, believe me, I know.
Yeah, but it tastes so good. But you just gotta have a little.
Oh, it was good.
You just gotta have a little. Yeah. That's the key, right?
Yep, yep.
Oh, man.
Everything in moderation.
Exactly. That's what it's all about. I really wanted to ask this. My wife also was really interested in how you felt about the way Mad Men ended. So, I mean, I know you loved the show. We always talked about it when we were working together. But the way Draper was in the lotus position meditating, and then you turned that whole experience into an ad. Mm-hmm. How did that make you feel?
Well, you know, I may have interpreted that ending a little different than a couple of my friends had, because... I think I mentioned to you I'm basically a Pollyanna.
Yeah.
So I believe in the goodness in people and people evolving and finding themselves. And I love that ending. By the way, I know the guy who did that commercial, Harvey Gabor, who worked with Bill Backer, and they created that commercial. Harvey Gabor and I were part of the big Google experiment, Project Rebrief. It's still online, by the way, if you want to look on it. Yeah, we went to New York together. We went to the Cannes Lions together during this Google thing. So he told me a lot about how the struggles in creating that commercial. But getting back to Don Draper, what I saw is that in that moment of meditation, and I think I saw a subliminal little smile, that something was released in him, a goodness that led to that incredible, heartfelt commercial that actually could have done some good for humanity. And that's the way I saw it, that in a way he used his talents in a positive way and was redeemed.
Yeah, as a human. He found himself again.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, I kind of, as a mild cynic, for me it was like some people never change. It's like I thought he was going to ditch advertising. He was going to do something completely new with his life, you know, find different meaning. But at the end of the day, Don was Don. He was going to do what he was good at. Yeah. He had a skill, and that's
Well, maybe that's the genius of the way they shot it.
Exactly.
I
love the ending, personally. I think that was a truth. That was a human truth right there, that you can evolve, you can find yourself, you can do all these things that are going to help you open up and be a better person. But at the end of the day, there's something, a thread in you that's there in you throughout your entire life.
Yep.
You know, and that's kind of, and I think also the way the character was written, how he just, no matter what happens, he still ends up cheating on whoever he's with. It's like, this dude just isn't going to change. You know?
How can you not love him? Come on.
I know. And then John Hamm just did a great job too. So it was like a double whammy. The character was well written and John was fun to watch too.
Yeah. One of the things I talked about in my book is because these were young Jewish and Italian kids off the streets of Brooklyn and the Bronx, that all of a sudden in this very glamorous world of advertising, supermodels, super sex, super parties, and they're in positions of creating, you know, advertising to cast and hire these people and go to fancy parties. And, you know, there was a lot of, obviously, promiscuity that led to some bitter breakups and divorces. But in a way, it's not that hard to understand why. I mean, they kind of married their high school sweethearts. They thought they'd probably never go more than 10 blocks past the street they grew up on in Brooklyn. And now all of a sudden they got fame and glamour and money. They're traveling to Europe. They're on glamorous shoots.
And opportunities to be with all sorts of attractive people that they never imagined they'd have the opportunity to be with. That type of temptation. A lot of celebrities these days crack, too, under that type of pressure.
Yeah. And there was good grass going around. I think the business never lost its martinis. It's three martini lunches, or two martini lunches. But this generation was getting more into smoking grass.
As the years went on, right? Through the 60s into the 70s.
Yeah, then it got more dangerous. I'd say late 70s, early 80s into the cocaine, which everybody said was, and that wasn't just advertising. That was every business.
Everywhere, especially Hollywood.
Yeah. And I was working with movie companies, and it actually became part of commerce. You know, I heard stories of production companies that would slip cocaine to the client as a way of saying, thank you for your business. and it was, you know, the big myth was that it's not habit forming, not going to hurt you. It's all right. It's just fun. And a lot of people got hooked, and had to fight it for a long time. Some people died. So, that wasn't so healthy. I think of the, 60s and maybe early 70s with grass as a little more innocent time of discovery.
It's a different substance. It doesn't, doesn't squeeze all the happiness out of your brain in 15 minutes. You know, it's a different vibe.
Yeah. And I think that's why it's so good that it's being legalized now.
Completely.
And also helping a lot of people with pain management. Diseases.
And they should be studying it. They should study how to even more use it as a medicine. You know, there's so many different ways. Even now, I don't know if they're fully have decriminalized LSD, but there's been studies where PTSD, it almost like hits the reset button on all those fears and emotions and trauma. Mm. They've been seeing good results with people feeling better coming out of post-traumatic stress. Yeah. With those experiences. They just decriminalized mushrooms in Oakland and in Colorado. So it's for the sake of science, you know.
Yeah, for sure.
It can be really good for people.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
It's a healthy thing.
It is.
Take your vitamin M.
Yeah. It can be once we understand it. Because, you know, just like even with Tylenol, you take too much.
Yeah.
Fry something.
Anything you take too much of.
Yeah.
Chocolate cake. I mean.
Beets. You know, you ever drink too much beet juice? It makes you feel really weird.
Really?
Yeah.
I have to try that.
Oh.
Now that you mention it.
Yeah.
I'm still a child of the 60s.
Hey, it's all about experimentation, right? You're a creative person, I would say. And creative people love experimenting. They love trying things that don't make sense. They love trying new things to see what happens.
Yeah.
You know?
Well, if you go back to more traditional alcohol, I don't know if you know the story of the exploding clown for Jack in the Box.
No.
Where were you in 1980?
I was born in 85.
You little punk.
Yeah.
Well, we had the Jack in the Box account out in LA, and they were in trouble. They couldn't compete with McDonald's and Burger King. And we ran a whole new strategy of coming up with adult products, because this, you know, was the clown, it was kids, it was. And they were creating new, really interesting products, hot ham and cheese supremes and hot beef and this and that. And so we were charged with coming up with an exciting new TV campaign to introduce these great new products. And we came up with our typical Wellsrich Green, going to entertain you. They were very clever. And people in focus groups laughed us out of the room because they were calling Jack in the Box gag in the bag. They didn't believe it. New product, get out of here. So the strategy was amended to convince people that we've changed. We had to come up with a big idea to say we've changed. So, to my point, the pressure was on.
Yeah.
And one night, fueled by several tumblers of Dewars on the rocks, I came up with my big idea that this clown was really a silly kiddie type character. And he's responsible for all these silly, you know, bad food and lack of quality. So let's blame it on the clown and then let's blow the mother away.
Oh, man.
And it's a simple, but almost, you know, so I came into work and I talked to some people. First, they laughed. They said, you can't be, no, let's blow them away. And so Bob and I wrote a very clever commercial. It was clever. I know it was clever because it tested well. But an old lady, this is long before Clara Peller and Where's the Beef? This was before that. She pulls up to Jack in the Box. Excuse me. Hang on.
Go for it. I'll do the same.
Old lady in a 1940s Packard pulls up to Jack in the Box, sees them strapping dynamite. These two guys are strapping dynamite to the Jack in the Box clown. She says, "What are you doing to the Jack in the Box clown?" And the guy says, "He's going bye-bye, lady." "But he's so cute." They go, "Cute was the old Jack in the Box restaurants. Now we stand for great new food." And we cut to the product, like our new hot ham and cheese supreme. We build the product. He hands it to her and says, "The food is better at the box." She takes a taste. "The food is better at the box." "Waste him!" She totally changes character. "Waste him!"
Oh, that's awesome.
That was a big line. So, if we have time for the rest of this story, this is really interesting.
Yeah, let's hear it.
Well, the client-agency relationship was very frayed, and they had hired a new marketing director. You know what happens when the new marketing directors come in? They fire your ass.
Mm-hmm.
So I had to present this idea to the new marketing director, which I did. And lo and behold, he says, "Oh, that's a big idea. That's exactly what we need." Oh, great. This guy's smart. He's nice. Next day, he comes in and fires us. Fires the agency. Fortunately, Mary Wells Lawrence was in our offices at the time. She had seen the idea because she knew we were in trouble. She loved the idea. She writes a personal letter to the chairman of Ralston Purina, which owned Jack in the Box at the time, saying, "This is unfair. I've seen the idea that will turn your business around. We would like to produce this commercial at our own expense and test it. And if it does well, we will keep the account." And the chairman says, "Well, how can we turn down an offer like that?"
Hey.
So he tells the marketing director to unfire us, which really pissed him off. So now the pressure was on. Mary basically guaranteed this was going to work. Her reputation, the agency's reputation, our reputation.
Yeah, bet it all on an idea.
Oh, man. So we go, we shoot the commercial with our own money. It comes out great. But now we have to put it into testing. It was Burke testing, which was an on-air test. It runs one time, and they call people to see if they remember the commercial, if they remember anything about the commercial, what they can play back. And that computes into a score. The average score was 22. If you go 7 points higher, you're good. If you go to 30 or above, you're golden. So that's what we're praying for. We're going to keep this again. We're going to get a 30.
Yeah, yeah.
So we put it into testing, and the tensions are high at the agency, and we're waiting one day to get the results. Bob and I are sitting in our office looking out at the Pacific Ocean, and the account guy bursts in the room. "We got the score. We got the score." I go, "Did we get a 30? He says, "No, we didn't get a 30. Oh, shit. We got a 70 fucking 2.
Holy.
It's the highest fast food score in the history of the category. Not, what's more, they remembered everything. The food is better. Jack in the Box is changing. No more clown. And so that was one of those great heroic stories when everything, you know, comes together.
Best feeling.
And we kept the account. And one more piece of good news. 1 month later, the asshole client resigns to pursue other interests.
Uh-huh. So. Cherry on top of that one.
Right.
I mean, I believe it. Just you telling me, like you just explained it here sitting at this coffee table, and I was like, oh my God, that's hilarious. I can only imagine. I feel like I've seen it, but I can't remember.
You can see it on YouTube.
Yeah, now I gotta YouTube it, but that's awesome. That's such a great idea.
Yeah.
That's what Domino's and McDonald's were trying to do recently, right? Trying to turn the brand around.
Yeah. I can't remember what they did, but...
It wasn't quite as extravagant as that. Domino's basically just said, we're using new ingredients at all Domino's locations. And then McDonald's with the, we use real beef now.
Well, you're saying they've changed their formulations to be different, but what did they do in advertising to make you feel it?
Oh, not anything as good as that, that's for sure. Yeah. They tried to go here in the head and not in the heart.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. That's it. You know, and it's also like... People with a vision like Mary Wells Lawrence to say, oh, this is a big idea. This is worth spending our own money in defiance of, yeah. If you know it, you know it, and you do it.
Yeah. Felt it.
God, nobody's going to buy the book. I've told all my stories.
Yeah. Oh, man. I'll have to sell this podcast instead of the book. Well, Howie, it was a pleasure. It was a pleasure talking to you. Thank you for spending time with me and going through all this stuff.
Oh, I'm happy to. Great to see you again. I think he has some really smart questions. And go buy I Can't Believe I Lived the Whole Thing. Now I'm going to give you a free copy.
Yeah. This episode was brought to you by Magnum Appliance Repair. Is your washer making funny noises? Is your dryer leaving your clothes wet? Is your refrigerator running? Well, you better go and catch it. Magnum Appliance Repair will help diagnose and repair virtually anything that's wrong with your washer, dryer, fridge, oven, dishwasher, or ice maker. Mention the code word APRICOT for a free diagnosis. Find them at magnumappliance.com. We're also brought to you by Mediafy Communications. They're literally public relation wizards. I swear to you. When I told them about my weird life as an Instagram artist and a podcaster, they honestly understood my needs better than I did and pointed out ways to grow that I never even imagined. You know, it was crazy. They know things. Put your PR in their hands and you will not be disappointed. Find them at mediaficoms.com. That's media, FYCOMMS.com. If you enjoyed this episode, please, please, please leave us a review on iTunes and also follow us on Instagram, YouTube, and Twitter for weekly content. On the next episode, we're going back to the old, original, regularly scheduled programming. I did these two interviews as a nice little break, but I've, during this time, been collecting more thoughts and ideas for the next one, and I think I have enough. I got a bunch of songs, a bunch of ideas, and yeah, we'll see what happens. That's it. See ya!